Welcome to Positive Personal Power with hope, aspiration, and encouragement. Our goal is to build and enhance people's confidence and strength to handle life's challenges. Now, let me introduce you to your host, Nathaniel Skula.
So I'm privileged today to be joined by two fantastic ladies, Sahar Hashemi, OBE, and I hope I pronounced your name right. I'm really bad with pronunciation. Thank you. And you are best known as the co-founder of the coffee chain Coffee Republic, and you also launched a confectionery brand, Skinny Candy, and you're a best-selling author of two books as well, which is exciting.
Thank you. Great to meet you, Nathaniel.
Thank you for joining us. And I'm joined by my lovely co-host, Nadia Russo, who is the CEO and founder of Auto New Media.
Nice to be here as always, Nat.
And we've got lots of good questions here. So we're very interested to learn more about you and your career and what drives you and that sort of stuff. So into the first question, can you tell us a bit about you, who you are and what drives you to do what you do?
I suppose my life is, I'm known as an entrepreneur formally, and I suppose that's my label. And now I talk about entrepreneurship, I write books about entrepreneurship, and I suppose I kind of encourage entrepreneurial behavior in people because I've come across so many people who have this dream of one day doing something and they never do because entrepreneurship is something that a lot of people dream of it, but it just is really scary. And people never take that leap. So I kind of, from the experiences of the two businesses I've started and sold and kind of got rid of, they're in the past for me now. But I think I use as lessons to really share with people what I know to take the leap and not have this dream of starting a business remain just that for them, just a dream. And it's such a pity.
That's fabulous. And one of those businesses was a major coffee chain, the Coffee Republic, and started in the UK. It's a country not very known for its love for coffee. So what exactly was the impetus for starting a coffee chain in like tea country?
The story is actually, I never wanted to be an entrepreneur. I had no interest in coffee. You know, I don't even come from a family of entrepreneurs. And I was actually a lawyer working in a very corporate environment in a big law firm. And it was on a trip to New York. My brother was working in New York at the time as an investment banker. And I just remember I went to visit him in New York. And the very first morning I was in Manhattan, I got up with terrible jet lag you get when you cross the Atlantic from the UK side, thinking, oh my God, like I need to wake up. Like I'm so jet lagged. I need a cup of coffee. And basically, I just remember thinking this is in the early 90s and I'm in America, and America was known for horrible coffee. I mean, it was so bad. I can say that even us Brits could make fun of American coffee, where the joke was bottomless cup and, you know, sort of that brown liquid.
Starbucks is already around.
And, you know, just it was such a sort of weak coffee. And I kept thinking, well, I'm in America, you know, I'm not going to get what I would be normally getting in Europe. And I just remember walking down Madison Avenue and just getting this sort of smell of freshly ground coffee beans. And we all know the smell of freshly ground coffee beans is a pretty amazing smell first thing in the morning when you need a bit of caffeine. And I sort of followed the smell inside, almost like a cartoon. Like the aroma was kind of enticed me inside. And I walked into this place and it was called New World Coffee. And New World Coffee, unbeknownst to me, was actually the predecessor of Starbucks in New York. And I just fell in love with it when I walked in. I remember they had coffee beans framed on the walls and it was all about coffee. It was like I was entering coffee world and I could hear the sort of hiss of the coffee machine frothing the milk and drawing down the espressos. And I went to kind of make my order and I saw this amazing coffee menu and just all the pastries they had were so different. And I just fell in love with it. I just couldn't believe it. I just remember I ordered myself a latte and I was asked, would I like a skinny latte, a full fat latte, a skim milk, a soya? And I just couldn't believe there was that choice and I could have iced. And it was just an experience I'd never seen before. And I just thought how amazing. And all that happened was when I was in New York for that week visiting my brother, I would go every single day thinking, I just love this. I love walking out with these wonderful cups. And when it came to London, I just really missed it. And I couldn't believe we didn't have anything like it. It was just, there was nowhere for me to go in the morning and get myself a great cup of coffee. And that's really where it started in a way. And I just remember, I'll go on with the story, but I just remember I was sitting actually having a Thai meal in a Thai restaurant with my brother and my mother. We were just having a family meal, nothing special about the meal. And I just remember very casually, I mentioned to my brother that, you know, gosh, you know, those coffee bars in New York are so amazing. And it was so great to get up in the morning and, you know, go up and get myself a skinny latte and one of these wonderful new style coffee bars. And I just remember very innocently saying, I just can't believe we haven't got them here. We haven't got them in the UK. I just wish someone would open one of these American coffee bars in the UK. It would be so incredible. And as soon as I said this, my brother Bobby, he got the old light bulb you hear about. Mm-hmm. And sort of literally ding, the sort of light bulb went off for him. And he said, this is a great business idea. And my reaction was, you know, business idea? Like, this is not a business idea. I just meant I'm the customer and I want someone else to open it for me to go to it. But that's sort of really where it started. Really me wanting to drink skinny lattes that I'd been used to in New York back in London.
That's awesome. So what was the process from there? I know a lot of like new entrepreneurs that of course come to you for advice now are always like, okay, well, it always starts with this amazing idea, but it's just that process of execution that's so daunting. Like, do I get an investor? Do I bootstrap? What do I do? Do I do both? How did you make this dream a reality? I mean, not only did you start one coffee, it was a whole chain of coffee shops that you started.
And no, that's, I mean, great question, you know, because people have ideas and I now know so many people who've told me, oh, you know, we had that idea. You know, of course it was by that stage, people could see it all over New York, all over Seattle. And, you know, what we did with the idea was I just remember in that Thai restaurant when I said to my brother and he got the light bulb and I said, listen, I have no intention of starting this. You know, someone else should start it. And he said, do you know what? Do you know, let's just try this together. And I just remember the very next day, the first thing I did was I got on the Circle Line, which is the London tube system. And I just went to see if I was right, whether there was nothing like it. And I just remember one day researching in London, I realized there was nothing like it. And I came home and I was like, actually, maybe that's what people call a gap in the market. It's incredible. And it was very, very much step by step. You know, the first thing I did was start to write some sort of a business plan, you know, put the idea in my head on paper, because I really believe that, you know, we have 600 ideas a day, I think, but you've just got to put it down on paper. And as soon as you put it on paper, I think there's something tangible and you can work on it, start developing. So I always say to everyone, just whatever you've got, just don't leave it up here, because people can just bash it around. You know, it's very fragile. You know, put it on paper. And I started, you know, as I had this draft business plan, didn't even know what I was going to call it. We started kind of almost building it up from there. I remember I went back to New York. I took pictures of the coffee bar. That was the idea how we do it. And then I just remember thinking, okay, how do we raise money? And at that time, I have to say my brother was actually an investment banker. So I thought, well, this is the easy part because he's a banker, so he can raise money. And my brother had no idea how to raise £90,000, which is what, like sort of $130,000. And we ended up just going from bank to bank to bank. We got rejection after rejection. We got actually 26 rejections from bank managers. Eventually, the one bank manager we went to said he'll give us the loan to open the UK's first coffee bar chain. And it really went from there. So it, for me, very much, it's step by step. The problem is people think about it. They think big. And actually, contrary to what we believe, you shouldn't think big. You should, you know, at the back of your mind might be this dream of a nationwide chain of coffee bars. But actually, you know, entrepreneurship is about doing the small stuff. You know, right. little tiny, tiny steps, and you'll get there. So for us, you know, the process was do market research, business plan, raise money. Once you raise money, after many, many no's, find suppliers and do it. You know, but it's just little teeny steps you take every day, I think, rather than the huge steps.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just nodding away. I actually remember talking to a posh friend of mine called Ed, and about 6 months ago, a couple of years ago, he said, I remember when coffee actually came to the UK. And before that point, I mean, Nadia, you would have been about 10 years old probably when this happened.
When was this?
Well, back in the day, like this is like 20 years ago, right? Pretty much 15.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so I actually distinctly remember the switch between the old-fashioned tea houses and then these kind of really amazing flavors that were from the coffee and the caffeine, obviously, right? It's incredible, actually, incredible. Yeah, you pick the right timing.
It was all sort of, people were not used to going and getting a great cup of coffee. You know, they were sort of, in the mornings, I think you'd more go to the kind of office coffee machine, and then maybe lunch you go and get a sandwich. So there's a ritual of a great part of your day, starting your day, getting a great cup of coffee, hearing the kind of classical music when you're waiting, maybe bagging a muffin. It was almost a new experience, a new habit that we had to introduce the sort of the UK sort of consumer to.
It was funny though, because you can just remember when everyone's like, oh, I'll have a cup of tea, please. Oh, I'll have a pot of tea. And, you know, and then it was like, oh, give me some coffee. It was just funny, you know.
I remember actually, the bank managers we went to, the ones who rejected us were like, you know, listen, there's no way nation of tea drinkers. And they were like, what makes you think that you've got a coffee idea from America? Great, it's a great idea that works in America, but you're bringing it to a nation known for tea drinking. And you know, they were saying actually, you know, tourists come to this country and they like the tea drinking ritual, having your British tea time. Why would you bring coffee? Coffee will never work in a country that's great for tea. Well, of course, you know, I'd done some research, and I remember that time it was the start of sort of cheap travel. So people were going to Europe a lot. There was much more travel at that time. So, you know, and in Europe, they drank much more coffee. So slowly there was sort of by osmosis, European habits were coming in. But no one ever thought, everyone thought it was crazy to bring coffee to nation tea drinkers. And actually, I used to say when I did my research, we used to drink 7 times more tea than we drank coffee. But now we drink as much tea as we drink coffee, I'm happy to say. So people, you know, people's habits change, really. And that's what we got to realize. And there's change all around us. It depends on which entrepreneur fits where in that little gap that change brings.
Right. And timing is really important as well. So, I mean, being very perceptive to what's happening around you and the needs and desires of the marketplace. And obviously, you answered people's call for a really good coffee shop that eventually evolved into a chain of 110 stores. How did that evolution take place? I mean, obviously it wasn't overnight.
Yeah, no, it definitely wasn't overnight. I mean, it took us 1 year to open one store. And then the following year we opened one more. And I actually remember, Nadia, when we had 2 stores, I remember thinking, oh my God, we've actually got a chain. This is amazing. You know, which one do I go to of the 2-store chain I've got? And it was so exciting to have 2. Then we went 7, then 10, really basic, then 30, 60, 80. So, you know, very much growth was kind of to that extent. You've got to get ready for your next stage of growth. And I'm now judge a lot of business plans in the UK. I sit on a lot of these business awards and I see so many business plans which are, oh, we want to open 100 stores. And well, it's actually impossible to open 100 stores. But what's very possible to open one store, get the DNA right, then try how you do it with 2 stores, get that right, then try out 7 and then 30. And then next thing you know, you're on to 100. But when you set yourself big goals at the beginning, it's just impossible. Either you open 10 mediocre stuff that never work. And, you know, which is why you just got, you know, it's just this idea of big is sort of, I think it is sort of very much a bit of a myth. And it's all about starting small and sort of reiterating and adapting and tweaking and getting the momentum going.
For sure.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. So I'm going to ask you Question number four, I think. No, I'm not. I'm just playing with Nadia. So after Coffee Republic, you started Skinny Candy. So how did you come up with that idea and get that started?
Well, you know, there's a sort of saying about entrepreneurship which says kind of entrepreneurs scratch their own itch. And well, you know, Coffee Republic was definitely scratching my own itch because I love coffee in the morning. I mean, I really cannot, I don't know about you guys, but I cannot wake up without a great
cup
of coffee.
No, it's impossible.
Impossible. I wake up and just that sort of the first, I have a soy latte at the moment, the first, like, it's actually the best part of my day, that first sip of that coffee. Yep. So that was definitely me. And I love cakes and things. So that actually fitted perfectly because we made the best cakes and the best cookies and sort of, and I like the whole American thing, actually, the whole American sort of muffins and things, which is, we were the first to bring that to the UK. So that was scratching my own itch. And then when I sold out Coffee Republic, I wrote Anyone Can Do It. And because of that, I got on the book tour circuit and I was traveling a lot. And I noticed when I traveled and stuff, you always want to take sweets with you. And, you know, and I just remember eating sweets, but then I just had read a book about sugar and how bad sugar is really bad for you and how we should not have sugar. And it was sort of almost a bit ahead of the time where we all know sugar is bad. But I remember the book was called Sugar Busters and my mother had given it to me. It was like, oh my, I'm not going to have sugar. So I thought, what about having, you know, sugar-free sweets? That's great. And my grandfather was diabetic. So I felt so sorry for him. I used to always go and buy sweets for him that were diabetic sweets. So I knew there was a whole range of sweets without sugar. So then I started, then I thought, actually, what about a really hip brand, not a diabetic medical brand of sugar-free sweets, but a really hip brand. So I started Skinny Candy and, that was incredibly exciting. And, you know, it was known by Vogue as, like, you know, the hip brand of sugar-free sweets. And, you know, all the models were having it on the catwalks. And, you know, we had it in the kind of great department stores and really funky hotel minibars and stuff. And I got an offer from a big confectionery company very soon after, actually, two years after launching it, to buy it up. And they ended up buying it. And we were going to sort of grow it together. But, you know, it was too much of a kind of pioneer brand for a big company. So they just bought it and put it in a drawer. So you don't really see my little gorgeous sweets business anymore because this big company just ate it up, which is why, you know, I now talk about entrepreneurship with big companies because it's quite difficult when you're a big company to be entrepreneurial and deal with a really new product. So that's how that came about. I forgot what your question was, but I think, I think it was about Skinny Candy, right? Yeah.
Spot on. Very interesting. That's very interesting. It is interesting because innovation is sort of sometimes hampered, isn't it, by bureaucracy. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, because I mean, innovation should be really simple. You know, for me in life, it's always like, oh my God, I'm missing this. Oh, then this might be a great business idea. And, you know, exactly as sort of Nadia was saying, it's just, you know, by having the way you know there's a demand for it often is if you want it, you know, it's fairly sure that if you're really needing it yourself, that 20 other people are going to need it. And if 20 other people need it, more likely 20,000 other people need it. So, you know, it's just having a real zeitgeist of the kind of outside world, I think, is really important. And, you know, along with what you were saying earlier, Nadia, you know, people have ideas, but it's just they think it's a great idea. And there's no such thing as a great idea. You know, ideas are only good if they solve a problem. And, you know, the only way you're going to know if there's a problem is if you're in the consumer's shoes, knowing what the consumer needs, rather than people fall in love with their own ideas and they're not really knowing if anyone's going to use that idea. So that's what is really important. That's what, you know, kind of sometimes I think misses.
Oh yeah. I mean, I hear about that all the time when new entrepreneurs come to me for support, whether it be a marketing strategy or something more comprehensive. There's this idea that they can go from 0 to 100 all at once. And I'm like, who is telling you this? I don't know if it's just their own fantasy or they're watching too much TV and movies or what, because I tell them, you know, I'm not saying that you might not reach that milestone one day, but you have to understand that you have to crawl before you walk. You know, you're going to need to understand there is a process to reaching that big milestone. And I think you need to set a smaller milestone first so you don't feel disappointed in 6 months or a year when you don't come anywhere close to that really lofty milestone that you're putting out. And I know in both of your books, you get really motivational for new entrepreneurs and startups, and you give a lot of great advice. Could you kind of distinguish the different types of advice between each of your books and why new entrepreneurs should really pick up both copies?
Sure. Well, the first book, when I sold from Coffee Republic, my first business, you know, I never considered myself an entrepreneur because I was very much, I was never the entrepreneurial type. I was never creative. You know, I wasn't that kind of typical school dropout that showed amazing creativity in childhood, that, you know, my teachers would remember me because I would, you know, sell sweets at the school playground, or, you know, none of those little genes that people think, oh, that child's going to be entrepreneurial. I was very, very straightforward, which is why I became a lawyer. And you can't get more straight and sort of straightforward, and I think kind of that being sort of left-brained than being a lawyer. And it was really only after I, you know, had that moment in New World Coffee in New York, had that moment in the Thai restaurant with my brother, that, you know, next thing you know, this idea starts germinating, and we follow this idea in this very zen way for 5 years. And it was literally just following what this idea we had, like it became its own person in a way, and we were sort of following it. And 5 years later, I'm like, oh my God, actually I've got 110 coffee bars and I'm known as an entrepreneur. And at that time in the UK, where we were based, there was really just about one entrepreneur in the whole of the UK that people knew, and that was Richard Branson. And, you know, there was this sort of idea that normal people aren't entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are really right. Swashbuckling extroverts, you know, kind of, you've got the same in America. You know what I mean? Yeah. I just don't name names.
Larger than life personalities.
You know, you got to like kind of, you know. And so that's when I just thought, actually, my God, you know, I suppose I am an entrepreneur. I didn't even have time to think about it. And just because there was a bit of a hiatus in my life after I've sold, and, you know, there was a huge sense of loss, actually, and sort of emptiness, because I loved this business and it occupied me and it wasn't there anymore. And someone said, write a book about it. And I was like, you know, I can't write a book. I don't know how to write even. But I remember at that time, thank God, there were just fax machines and notes and stuff. You know, stuff wasn't kind of virtual. So it was very physical, the notes between me and my brother and all the sketches. And I just remember I had them in a file and I just started going through them and think, wow, there is method to this madness, actually. And what my brother taught me in terms of entrepreneurship was step by step. He guided me through the steps. And I was like, that's what I could do for other people. Because if I could become an entrepreneur, then anyone can become an entrepreneur, which is why we called the book Anyone Can Do It, because genuinely at that time, no one had ever told it the story, you know, the whole ups and downs, breakthroughs and breakdowns, you know, warts and all story of what entrepreneurship is like. There was always, oh, I had the idea and I made it happen. Like, I'm a genius and you can't do it. I thought the only way is for me to show the sketchings and the drawings and the pains and the crying and the arguments, and because that's what real life entrepreneurship is. And it was an incredible sort of year that I spent putting this all together and writing Anyone Could Do It. And, you know, I'm really kind of, I think in a way for me, it's my proudest achievement, because it's always there as it is. And it's kind of the cult kind of book on entrepreneurship is motivated. I can almost thousands of people have written to me saying how that was the push for them to start a business. And that's been incredibly, actually the guy that started, I don't know if you guys ever listened to Calm on the Calm app, which is very popular.
I put myself to sleep last night with the Calm app.
There you go, exactly. So Michael Acton Smith, a UK entrepreneur, I have the letter he wrote that I inspired him with Anyone Could Do It to sort of get on the path of entrepreneurship. So things like that, I'm very proud of. I did that. So that was my first book, Anyone Can Do It. And then people started asking me to talk about it on the book tour. And then big companies were saying, actually, do you know what? This bit of this kind of little entrepreneurial sort of modus operandi you talk about, we can actually benefit, because, you know, we're a big company, but doesn't mean we've got to be some paper pushing, stagnant. We know we need a bit of creativity. We need new ideas. We need a bit of innovation. And we need a bit of fun and a bit of life and soul. And, you know, how can you infuse a bit? Can you come and tell us your story? And I used to come along, and the joke always was when I came with my book, Anyone Could Do It, to a big company, they always thought they were actually, they were being made redundant, because they thought, like, you know, like this was like their sort of final thing, whereby if I spoke, then once they got made redundant and lost their jobs, they could always start a business. So it was always this joke that, you know, either people are going to leave, or why are they giving us entrepreneurship? We work in a big company. It doesn't make sense. Like, are we about to lose our jobs? And it was actually saying, no, this is the new way. This is the new MO in a large company, the new way of thinking. So I started speaking and really became very aware of what happens in big companies, what the barriers are that an employee doesn't think it can think and act like an entrepreneur. So on the back of sort of, you know, almost I think over now 500 big companies I've worked with around culture of entrepreneurship, I wrote my book Startup Forever. And again, the title was Startup Forever is because the mistake we made at Coffee Republic was we thought you're a startup and then you grow up and become a big company. Right. So I thought startup is something you grow out of, whereas actually I have since learned startup is something you fight very hard to maintain. So in a way you have to be a startup forever kind of thing, rather than just a startup as a phase you grow out of. So yeah, so that's the history behind my thesis. What do you say?
It's really about mindset. So you're saying essentially in the book, you're really putting forth the idea that Startup Forever is a mindset and that people should maintain that rather than just want to toss it away in exchange for evolving into, say, like a public corporation. Like, oh, well, we are no longer a startup. We've gone public now. We're huge. We're out of that phase. And instead, that often will set up an entity for kind of for stagnation and a lack of innovation.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. And as we know, it's all about mindset. You get the mindset right, you behave in a certain way. And, you know, for me, it's access, this entrepreneurial way is, you know, now coming on to the world where we're at right now, post-COVID, my God, you know, we all have to start up. We all have to start up again. And that's, we need that mindset more than ever.
Yeah, for sure. I know we're skipping around a little bit, but Nat, I'm going to allow you to bounce off that COVID question or ask that COVID question that's based off.
Okay. What, yeah, we can skip around a bit. And when I write this on the blog, I'm going to say, and some of these questions may not be in order.
They were actually, you know, and everyone is going to be condemned for that.
But I will. I will be in trouble.
Forever.
I'll be in big trouble. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, how has COVID-19 impacted you? And if so, you know, what have the implications been?
I mean, what can I say? Like every other human being on the planet, you know, it absolutely pulled the rug from under our feet. You know, we've all been massively pushed out of our comfort zone. We've all realized that without realizing, you know, the problem is when you're in a boom, you never realize you're in good times. You never think, oh my God, times are good. You're never aware of it until someone takes away the good times. So, you know, like every single human being on the planet, every single adult, you know, I have been pushed right out of my comfort zone. You know, what I assume was always there, my market, what I do has just been taken away from me. And it's just a question of starting again and, you know, teaching myself to put the fear aside, not to indulge in the news and just think, listen, you know, there are certain tools I've got, there are certain things I can do. And I'm gonna make this happen. You know, we've got this. There are tools that we need to deploy and we need to, you know, not worry about how things were and try to hold on to if only things were how they were, you know, on the 1st of February. They're not, and we've got to adapt and kind of go out there and build again and make it again, I think.
How do you think the mindset that's put forth by your book, Startup Forever, can be applied to business owners and new business owners, especially right now, given these uncertain times? How can they utilize that mindset to really push them forward to not just survive, but to thrive right now?
Yeah, no, I mean, it was always, you know, the idea of everyone wanted the entrepreneurial mindset because everyone was like, it's a great thing to have, but it was almost a luxury. You know, it wasn't a necessity. In a big company, you already had that mindset, you know, a lot of, or even small companies getting big, you know, you were sort of set in your way and there were certain ways you behaved. And it was very difficult to actually leave that comfort zone and get yourself behaving in a new way. And I think sometimes, you know, necessity pushes us out of our comfort zone. It's a good thing. It brings change, you know, kind of adversity. You know, one of my big mottos in life is adversity breeds opportunity. And in this scenario, we have to leave that mindset because a lot of things we did, we can't do anymore. So we just can't continue on the same treadmill because that's all gone. So we have to think of a new way. So for me, the only way is entrepreneurial. And I say this to every company, you know, we've got to go back to our customers, see what their problems are, really feel what they're, really make a deep connection as to what the issues are, and start from there. And that's the best way to start and reinvigorate our businesses. And I think for a lot of people, once we're through this initial shock, which I think we are in the phase of recovery, we'll look back and think, wow, you know, I did something great there. I really rebuilt my business. And that shock maybe is what I needed to just pull myself out of the, this is how things are, and the complacency in a way, which, you know, as they say, success is a really bad teacher. It's kind of this sort of thing that really shows us what we're made of. And we end up accessing these tools we've all got, because, you know, when you start a business, you have nothing else to rely on. You know, when you start a business, you have no safety net, you have nothing, you've got no customers. You're pulling stuff out of thin air. But because you have to pull stuff out of thin air, you end up using resources you've got inside, and you sort of almost surprise yourself with how you're performing, because that's all you've got. And when you have a team around you, they've got nothing else to rely on. So they operate at a really high level. And I think this adversity is going to make everyone really pull everything they've got, you know, use up every bit of the kind of their 100% resources they've got inside them. Yeah. There's going to be no underutilized resources for anyone. We have to get everything just to survive. And that's a great thing. And sometimes we need that. So maybe we all needed that in a way.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Nodding away here. it's fascinating though, isn't it? You know, when your back is against the wall, what new skills you can learn. If you know you've got 8 weeks to learn something new and make something happen, it's incredible actually what you can learn, really. Yeah.
The thing, your back's against the wall. That is exactly it. That is what everyone's at, and they'll surprise themselves, because that's how you perform at your best. Out of your comfort zone, with your back against the wall, with no resources, you know, you see how creative you are, and everyone out there will see how incredible they are and how many tools they had which they were never even accessing.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously you are such a positive person. You just exude positivity, particularly with both of your books. How did positivity become so important to you, and why is it so important to you?
Oh gosh, I mean, you know, what's life worth living if we're not going to be positive and enjoy every minute of it? And I just, I just can't think of any other way. And, you know, like every normal person, I have times where I get up and it could be like on the wrong side of the bed, but, you know, I've got my rituals every day that I do to get myself into that positive mindset, because when you get there, life is positive back at you, you know. And if only I could tell people, it's just, you know, you look on positively at life and you get positive back. And if you look on negatively, you get negative back. So I'm always recalibrating myself with these rituals I've got in the morning to just get myself all day right. And we have to, as human beings, I think our brain is conditioned for like same old, and a bit of negativity. And especially now with all the news we hear 24/7, it's a conscious effort to get ourselves in a positive mindset. And, you know, it doesn't come naturally to me. I work hard at it every single day.
So what are your rituals then in the morning?
Oh God, rituals. Okay. So first one actually is, I really believe in, do you guys know Wim Hof? Like Wim Hof, he's this sort of amazing guy, actually, you should look him up. And he believes in cold water therapy. So in the morning, he's that sort of breath guru and sort of cold water. He's incredible, actually, if you ever look him up on YouTube. Wim Hof, WIMHOF, and really believes in these sort of cold water showers. So in the morning, once, and this is in London, winter, any time of day, actually, after I have my shower, I have a very, very cold shower whereby I'm almost gasping to the extent my husband can hear it because the water is so cold. But it's incredible because after that cold shower, just my whole energy of my body changes. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, even this is, you know, I get feel warmer, paradoxically, in the sort of cold therapy. Important. And then I, thank God, I actually work from home. I think like a lot of self-employed people, so ritual is, I work from home. My ritual is I have a dog and I sort of call it a faux commute. So I have to get the dog to park. And so I treat that as my commute. We get into a car, we drive to the park as if we're commuting, you know, we have the walk. And then when we come home, it's very much like we've come to the office. At that point, like my husband's left, the house has become my office. And it's very, very much, hello, I'm entering the office with my dog. I think we've gone somewhere where we haven't. Then my sort of, and then when I have my morning coffee at that time, I do something called the morning pages. That is something that was originated by Julia Cameron, who wrote that great book called The Artist's Way. And it's 3 pages of longhand every morning. So I have this little notebook next to me. And I just have a sort of pen that's easy to write with this notebook. And it's 3 pages of A4. I just fill it up with whatever comes up. You know, whatever frustrations, whatever dreams, whatever plans. I just have to write 3 full sides every morning. And I write that and I rip it up afterwards. But I just have to. And that really clears up your energy for the day. I love that. I have my cup of coffee. Hugely important. And then the whole day is normal. And then the evening has to be exercise, some sort of a cardio exercise whereby you're sweating, and then a bath, and then breath exercises, very much. So then I'm very relaxed for the evening. So that's my ritual, I think.
You maintain that like 5 days a week, 6 days a week, every day? Or does it ever like vary for you? Or?
Yeah. Almost every day, because I actually feel it. Like kind of if I miss something, I just then don't feel at all. You know, I don't sleep well, and I think if you don't sleep well, your whole day's ruined. So I always make sure I have it, make enough time for all those things. And you know, anyone self-employed listening, it's very important to, you know, structure your day, and especially when everyone working from home, just to sort of almost in the morning get out. You know, the worst thing you can do is get up, you know, look at the phone, get onto your desk. I mean, there's just no way you're, and even that's 20 me. Minutes. Oh my God, Nadia, no, it just makes such a difference. Even 20 minutes kind of getting your, you know, a cold shower, that's what you could do, Nadia, yeah. if it's too hot there in your heat wave. A cold shower where
you just. Yeah, I have central air though, so it's not like it's 100 in here. I mean, I will say, like, I have a semi-ritual, you know, like, I got to do the coffee. The coffee isn't a huge part of the day. You know, I sit and I drink it and I savor it and I reflect. The journaling, now, I love that you talk about, you call it the morning pages, right?
That's exactly, fabulous. Exactly.
That's fabulous. Yeah, that is one thing that I want to get back into, and the stream of consciousness writing. But I'm curious, because you mentioned ripping up those pages. That's really interesting. Is that part of that ritual? Is there something about ripping up those pages?
Yeah, you know what? It's interesting, because whenever I've read about morning pages, it doesn't say for you to rip it up, but I quite like it because I think it's sort of quite cleansing. Otherwise, it becomes like a bit of a diary, and I'm worried that if I read it later, I'm sort of almost editing it and doing, making it look better, like for you know what I mean? I'm sort of putting on a show for myself. Whereas if I know I'm going to rip it up, I just feel otherwise I feel like keeping it there, and then I just don't want anyone to look at it, like, do you know what I mean? Then I'm completely unencumbered in what I put down on there, and it's very cleansing to rip it up, because there's a sort of emotional healing thing where they say you write stuff and then you burn it, sort of thing. So I feel by ripping it up, it's just not there. I'm done with it. It's kind of I leave the rest to the universe rather than sort of.
Right. So then it feels a little less contrived, like, oh, I'm doing my writing and then it's there, versus like I'm writing, getting this out of me and I'm ripping it. It's been released and I'm done and I'm
released. Exactly. Exactly. So it's not a kind of diary where you might hold as something kind of valuable to you, that because I think then you'll hold on to those thoughts. And actually some of the stuff I write on a bad day, I quite like to rip it up and never see it again, frankly. Okay. So, yeah.
Cool.
That's very interesting. We speak to so many successful people like you, and it's great to actually, you know, notice that everyone has bad days. Yeah. And you know, I speak to so many people about this conversation, you know, and it's like, well, actually we're all human. And if you didn't have a bad day, you wouldn't have a good day. Right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The end of something actually really impacted me was Tony Robbins. I found something, it was a sort of 10-minute clip Tony Robbins had, and he said our brains are, you know, made for, you know, sort of disaster and negative thinking in a way. Like it's just the default of our brain is to think negative, so worry, you know, those are defaults of our brain. So it's actually, so once you understand that, then you don't expect to wake up going, whoa, positive, that actually it's work to get yourself into the negative phase. But once you work on it, then it's easy. That's, I think, been huge for me, not to expect to sort of, you know, be positive, but actually know that being positive is something you work on, and it's hugely satisfying when you work on it. So it just, once you understand that, then it just takes away the pressure of being naturally positive. And the more positive you are, the sort of contagious it is. So I am.
Wow.
Fantastic. So I'm going to ask this question because I think you've already really covered so much. You've given so much great advice for the listeners, right? But what's the most important piece of advice for entrepreneurs?
Gosh, I think for aspiring entrepreneurs, I think my biggest piece of advice is just don't think too much, just do it. You know, I meet so many people with brilliant ideas that are in their heads, and I'm like, just do it, just make a little tiny prototype, just put it on, you know, just put it on paper. If you're trying to give a service, you know, try it small. Don't wait for it to be perfect and big and amazing before you launch it. You know, so many people have ideas and they're waiting, you know, they're like thinking, oh my God, honestly, when I do it, it's going to be grand. No, when you do it, it's going to be ugly and it's going to be small and it's going to be embarrassing. That's how it's going to be, because that's how great things start. They don't start, you know, a great idea never starts as a great idea. You have the idea, you know, you start it and then you see how it develops, because sometimes it could be a different idea, but you've just got to start and get it out of here and on paper, or on in a sort of some form of a prototype, a tool. And that's what is, I think, life-changing. If only I could get so many people to do that, it would just make, you know, it's, if you got an idea for a hand cream, make the bloody hand cream and sell it outside your house. You know, if you got an idea for, you know, any kind of service, just do it and then see how that works out. I would have never done anything. And, you know, I'm never scared to just try. You know, my motto in life is leap and the net will appear. And life is just take the leap. Don't think, because when you sit there on top of that cliff, considering the pros and cons and the risks, and it's just a really awful place to be, because you're looking at that cliff, at that huge empty space in front of you, and you don't want to spend your life. Just take the leap and see what happens. Life's too short.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, totally. Well, thank you so much. It's been absolutely brilliant. I think, yeah. I'm going to have to read your books now, both of them. It looks like I need to.
I'll send them to you. Oh my God, I'll send them to you.
Thank you. That's very kind. I'd appreciate that a lot. So,
last piece of advice, Sahar, what would you say your personal positive superpower is for you? Like, what is that?
God, it's such a difficult one. I suppose it's just, you know, I've done it and I just know anyone can do it. I just, you know what I mean? I've done it. I never thought I could do it. And that's why I just want to go around telling everyone, listen, honestly, you can do it. You've got no idea what you're made of, but you'll only know once you just take that leap and go on the journey, because I would have never, ever thought, a young me, that I could have done that, but I just did it. And then I could see it just sort of, it happened. So I just want everyone not to have the dream in their head. Just do it. Just go make it happen.
Fantastic. Well, so people can find you on your website. They can find you on your Instagram and everywhere else, right? You're all over the place, aren't you?
Exactly. Instagram, LinkedIn, my website, exactly.
Super. Startup Forever on Instagram.
And Twitter, exactly. But so Instagram, I'd love to, because I'm trying to promote my Instagram at the moment, my messages. So.
Super. Well, thank you, Nadia. It's always a pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Sahar, for coming on and speaking with us.
Thank you. I loved it. It was a lovely evening for me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Positive Personal Power. Do subscribe via your favorite podcasting app, and please leave us a 5-star review. Or sign up on our website, positivepersonalpower.net, for weekly emails and updates. And do share our episodes with your friends and on social media. Feel free to reach out anytime.